From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Flashback to the Mad Men days, a time when, on one end, high-powered executives married their secretaries, and on the other, factory workers supported their families on solid wages. Not anymore. Income inequality has changed American marriages. The CEO is now married to a partner in a law firm, creating power families. Further down the income ladder, the factory worker doesn't even have a job, which means for many, marriage is out of the question. This hour on Point, how income inequality is making marriage, remaking marriage, and the American family, and making it all even less equal. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of this economic analysis of the changing American marriage? Why do you think marriage rates are dropping amongst middle-class and low-income Americans? And what happens to our society when the rich marry each other and the middle-class and poor see marriage as an economic burden? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Now, this conversation has been spurred by a new book. It's called Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. And it's co-authored by June Carbone. She's chair in law, science, and technology at the University of Minnesota Law School. She joins us today from Minneapolis, Minnesota. June Carbone, welcome to you.
Happy to be here.
Also with us is Naomi Kahn, joining us from Washington today. She's professor at George Washington University Law School and co-author of Marriage Markets as well. Naomi Kahn, welcome to you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So first of all, let me just ask you the question, what prompted both of you, and June, let me just start with you, to take this really economic analysis and income inequality analysis to the institution of American marriage?
Well, our last book, which was called Red Families versus Blue Families, we looked at different parts of the country and we saw that the family was taking different forms. Divorce rates are higher in red states. Average age of marriage is higher in blue states. Fertility is higher in red states. We knew some of what we were looking at was wealth. Blue states are wealthier. And we knew the country is moving in two radically different directions, with the top buying back into marriage and the rest of the country, including the middle, moving away from it.
But when you bring in the red state, blue state thing, but this current analysis doesn't have really anything to do with politics, right?
Well, it certainly has a lot to do with politics, but it isn't the same analysis.
Uh-huh.
And so what we were trying to do is say, look at what's happening. There are these underlying economic changes. How do they explain something like marriage, which we don't think of at all as cold-blooded or motivated by how much money you can make? What are the feedback loops that produce these results?
I see. Naomi Kahn, so describe to us then what we are seeing now in terms of who's getting married, who's not getting married. How has marriage changed in the past generation as we've seen rising income inequality in America?
What we found is that marriage truly has become segregated by class. And people who have a bachelor's degree or higher are much more likely than those with some college or those who haven't been to college or than those with a high school diploma to get married. But it's not just that they are more likely to get married. They are also far less likely to get divorced. And so if you look at the divorce rates of people with a college degree or higher, among those who have gotten married, their divorce rates are half of those for people who have less than a high school diploma. So the wealthy are more likely to get married and they're more likely to stay married.
Right. In fact, in your book, if I may, I see that, you raise so many interesting findings in terms of who's getting married and who's not, that only one group has seen marriage rates actually increase since 1970, and that's women in the top 5% of incomes?
Exactly right. That's the only group in American society that has seen marriage rates increase. Now, the rates of marriage for people close to the top have remained about the same, lost a little bit. But it's then when you look at the bottom of the economic spectrum that you see a dramatic change in the rate of marriage.
Now, of course, there are many, many theories as to why this is happening. And we'll talk about how yours differs from some of the others that have been discussed on Point before, including lots of people saying that basically there's a hollowing out of the moral center of folks when it comes to marriage. But what is it about the economic situation that Americans in the middle middle incomes and lower incomes find themselves in that makes marriage a far less appealing prospect now than it was a generation ago? June Carbone.
Well, you know, when we talk to both men and women, what they want is the same thing. They want a partner. They want somebody who is going to share the burden of taking care of a family. And both men and women are really wary today of someone they think they have to take care of. So if you see, you know, a woman who's with a man who's cycling in and out of the labor force, can't hold a steady job, but is devoted to her, she'll live with him. She probably won't marry him. If you see a man who thinks, you know, he's working really hard, but he thinks, you know, times are tough, he wants a woman who is going to make him feel good about himself, help him get where he's going, and if he has to support her while she takes care of the children, he's wary.
But you talk about in the book how income inequality sort of plays out differently between how how it's having an impact on men in the country versus how it's having an impact on women, and how that flows into who's getting married and why. I mean, I just put kind of a complicated question, but Naomi Kahn, can you tease us out for it? Tease that out for us.
It is a complicated question, and it's particularly complicated because there's been a great deal of discussion about how women are improving their status. Wonderful books, The End of Men, The Richer Sex. So there's this belief that women are finally achieving equality. But instead, if you look at, if you do a breakdown by income, at the top, men are earning, there are more men at the top than there are women. Women have still not achieved equality in terms of income at the top. And so what that does is it means that for women in the middle and women at the bottom who are looking for a partner who will provide both economic support as well as caretaking support with children, their choices are more limited.
Now, what's so gives pause, let me just put it that way, about this is that for, it seems forever, for generations at least, marriage, rather than being seen as an economic burden, was seen as exactly the thing that was supposed to provide economic stability for families, right? I mean, but now basically you're saying we're seeing the opposite trend. June?
Yes. And here's why. If you create a world in which almost no woman, except that group at the top that didn't used to marry, could support herself, then she was better off by having a man, any man, who would take care of her because she was never going to earn enough to support a family on her own. That's changed. And to pick up on what Naomi has said, if you then think of women as wanting a man who earns about the same as they do, our economy puts more men at the top. So top women have more men to choose from and more men at the bottom who are effectively unmarriageable because they don't contribute much either financially or socially. And I want to say on that top, I gave this talk in Silicon Valley and some of the audience gasped. If you take not just the top, you know, 2%, but all college graduates, the wage gap has increased. That means the gender difference in wages, who earns more. Men have outpaced women among all college graduates since 1990, the disparity in income for the top group of men and women has increased. Hmm. And that makes marriage more attractive for women. And we'll leave men to Naomi.
Well, Megan, Jane, June, if I could just add that it's all a question of markets, and it's a question of supply and demand. And it's not that any individual woman or any individual man is deliberately going out on a market and bidding. But if you look at the macro trends, then it's a simple matter of supply and demand. And if you look at women in the middle and women at the bottom, many of the choices among men who they have, those men will be earning much less if they are earning anything. The unemployment rate among men with less than a high school education is high. And so if you look at who they can choose as partners, women's choices are more limited.
Right. Stand by there just for a second, Naomi, if you could, because we've got to take a break. We're talking about the new book, Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family, with Naomi Kahn and June Carbone. They're co-authors of the new book. We'll wrap up this segment with If I Were a Carpenter by Bobby Darin, who wonders how desirable he would be if he worked with his hands. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
If I were a carpenter and you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby? Would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby?
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Tom Ashbrook. And we're talking about how income inequality is reshaping American families and how we're increasingly seeing two tiers when it comes to marriages in America. We're talking with June Carbone. She's chair in law, science, and technology at the University of Minnesota Law School. She joins us today from Minneapolis. And with Naomi Kahn, professor at George Washington University Law School. She joins us from Washington. They're co-authors of the new book, Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. Now, June and Naomi, in a minute, I want to get to why this really, really matters in the long run. But I still want to just get our heads a little bit around, how much there has been a change between now and, say, two generations ago. Because, for example, I see that you cite some statistics that say in, 2003, more than 55% of married men and women had the same education level. How different is that from 50 years ago, from two generations ago? Naomi, you want to give a crack at that?
Sure. There's been, if you look two generations ago, college-educated women were less likely to get married than their less-educated counterparts. Today, that's changed, and they are far more likely to marry someone with comparable education. So that's been a change for women, and it's also been a change for men.
Mm. And I suppose the implication there is that when we have people at the same socioeconomic level marrying more than ever before, that wealth, education, power essentially gets further consolidated. Right, June?
Absolutely. And it's important to recognize the feedback loops on this, because part of what happens is, so when you look at college graduates, they now feel before they get married, they need to finish school. They need to go through the first set of parent-subsidized internships. They need to decide what city they're in. And then they become ready to settle down. And so they're at a point in life where there are fewer surprises. You know who it is you're marrying. You know a lot about them. When you look at what used to happen, you used to marry your high school sweetheart or maybe got married at college graduation. And so there were a lot of life changes you had to weather. Today, one of the reasons college graduates are doing better is they know who they're marrying, and they have they get married at a point where life has become more stable. For other people, one of the things we don't talk about is the uncertainty. Mm. When you talk about what breaks up relationships, A man losing his job is not fun to be with, and relationships, both marriages and cohabitations, often don't survive. A man being laid off, he tends to respond by drinking more, playing more video games. Laid off men help less around the house than fully employed men. And by the time he gets back on his feet, the relationship may not last. Mm. Both groups want stability. The top can find it. Women in the middle are finding they have to rely on themselves.
Well, I suppose a lot of folks hearing this don't want us to paint with too broadly a brush, because everyone reacts to the crisis or catastrophe of losing their jobs in very, very different ways. But Naomi Khan, let me ask you, I mean, the reason why this matters, and I think that the heart of this issue is that if we're seeing income inequality have such a strong impact on marriage, what we're essentially seeing is the impact then, the follow-on impact it has on the children of these marriages or these partnerships or relationships, that what you're saying is that it's one of the ways in which inequality is being further calcified into American society, because the presumption is that if wealthier people are marrying each other, they have more resources to put into their children than folks in the middle and lower incomes.
That's exactly right, Magna. What we're seeing is marriage. It's not marriage per se that should be the issue of concern. We see marriage as kind of that canary in the coal mine. Marriage, the increasing income stratification of marriage is an example of larger socioeconomic problems of the increasing economic inequality in our society. And so it's not family structure per se, it's economic inequality, with marriage as a marker of that economic inequality. But just in terms of how economic inequality plays out, in terms of the economic and social advantages in families at the top, until the early 1980s, for example, mothers, regardless of their education, spent about the same amount of developmental time with their children. In the words of Robert Putnam from Harvard, they spent about the same amount of time playing patty cake with their children. While today, about 40 years later, college-educated moms spend almost 50% more time than non-college-educated moms playing patty cake with their children. And it's not just patty cake. It goes all the way up through college. Children from low-income families are far less likely to go to college. And when they do go to college, they are far more likely to drop out of college than are children from high-income families. So it becomes a self-perpetuating, as June said, a self-perpetuating cycle.
Mm. I mean, how much can we say though, that the correlation is the cause to all these outcomes? I mean, that's the fundamental challenge when it comes to any kind of statistical or social analysis of such a huge, you know, issue such as marriage and children and the outcome that it has on children's lives, Naomi.
Well, we're not saying that the increasing stratification of marriage by class is a cause. What we're saying is it's an example of the larger socioeconomic inequality in our society. So it's economics that's more important than family structure in, for example, figuring out whether a woman who was born into poverty will remain in poverty. It's not the family structure per se, it's her socioeconomic status in which she was born. On the other hand, if two parents generally provide more resources, two married parents can generally provide more resources for their children than a single parent. So marriage becomes an example of the impact of increasing economic inequality.
Right. In fact, that was one of the more interesting graphs and charts in your book that I saw. That, you know, for example, June, over time, over the past several decades, we've seen the percentage of income or the amount of income that middle and lower income parents are able to spend on their children. Literally spend on their children for all sorts of opportunities, stay relatively the same. But we're seeing wealthy families spend a lot more, you know, decade by decade. So they're even choosing to put more money into their children.
Yes. And, you know, one of the things that we find as well is, again, these are cumulative. So you start with the question, where is the biggest disparity in the times parents spend the first year of life? When is that parent-child interaction most important to overall development? The first year of life. The newest studies are finding that things like Head Start interventions, we now have 30 years of data, whether or not they affect educational achievement or IQ, they affect things like the likelihood of diabetes 30 years later. Mm-hmm. It turns out that those experiences in the first year of life have lifelong consequences for health. They also interact with things like community support. When you look at children completing college, for example, if you hold steady for things like SAT scores or grades, you still see those higher-income children are more likely to complete college. The interventions when times get rough that parents provide both financially and emotionally are very important.
Right. And in fact, now that I think about it, I mean, the fact that middle and lower-income parents have been able to hold the amount that they spend on their children steady, in my mind, seems in and of itself quite an accomplishment, given that their real wages have been going down decade by decade when it comes to their actual dollar value. Jane is calling from Boston. You're on the air, Jane.
Hi, Magda. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on how at the top of the socioeconomic kind of ladder, for men, the picture is especially interesting because you have men who've married doctors and lawyers, but a lot of them have also married nurses and teachers who want to be at home, and they are looking for spouses who will actually want to be at home and not have careers. And I think that for women, that's also changed the picture for them. I mean, I always find it kind of interesting that at my children's school, there'll be teachers with masters in education who are married to say, you know, plumbers and electricians. But then some of them are also married to doctors. Mm. And so I'm seeing just that it's just so diverse in how people are matching up kind of from the middle to the top.
Right. Jane, thank you so much for your call. And Naomi Khan, I guess the implication of what Jane's saying is what we were talking about earlier, is that surprise, surprise, people in higher incomes have a greater diversity of choice than people when it even comes to finding a life partner than people at lower income levels do.
That is totally true. Two other responses to Jane's comments. The first is that women who are married to men at the top and women who are married to men at the bottom are those who are most likely to become stay-at-home mothers. And so it's women in the middle are less likely than women at the extreme top and at the extreme bottom to be the ones to stay home. And then the second comment is to say that what June and I are doing is looking at broad trends, and we're looking at general statistics. Although in the book we do have some stories, what happens, of course, to any particular woman, to any particular man as they match up is very different from what the general statistics might predict, or can be very different from what the general statistics might predict.
Right. Naomi and June, if you could stand by for just a moment, I want to introduce another voice into this conversation. Kevin Millard is professor of law at Syracuse University College of Law. He's co-editor of Loving v. Virginia in a Post-Racial World. He joins us today. He happens to be in South Korea, so he joins us today from Seoul. Kevin Millard, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna.
It's great to have you. Now, we wanted to include you in this conversation for a number of reasons, your expertise primary among them. But, a lot of people have said, and even June and Naomi do touch upon this issue in the book, that when it comes to the impact of income inequality on family life, the African American community has felt it long before before the rest of the country, since wage disparities have been so high amongst African Americans for so long. I just wonder, first of all, what's your response to what June and Naomi are saying about how income inequality is changing marriage in America?
Well, first of all, I think it is great, the work that they are doing, because it goes beyond race, because there's been so much almost a fetishization of what are Black people doing with marriage, right? There are all of these catastrophizing litanies of how much Black people are avoiding marriage, right? We have, starting with the Moynihan Report, where Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who ended up being a senator, was saying that we have a Black matriarchy and we don't have any men. And then in the 2000s, there are all of these articles and books, is marriage for white people? Is marriage for Black people, right? So then I think what they're doing is not just saying, oh, it's all Black people. They're definitely not doing that. They're saying this is a class problem and it's also an income problem. And I think it does disproportionately affect African-Americans. But I think what we need to look at is it's not only marriage, but it's the money that people have access to. And it's the different ways that Black people have found historically, even since slavery times, different ways that Black people have found to have families and to bond themselves to other people.
Right. And so, by the way, you referenced the Patrick Moynihan Report. That was, what, back in 1965, right, on the African-American family, right? And he basically said that he believes that the structure of the African-American family, or believed, he called it the fundamental problem that's creating a gap, or was creating a gap between African-Americans and the rest of the nation. Now, that report was called by many people to be, you know, resoundingly sort of racist, for lack of a better term. But I'm just wondering what you think about the underlying premise here, that lack of wages, lack of economic opportunity does have an adverse effect on people's attitudes about marriage.
I think it does. But here's the problem. There's so much placed on weddings that is not really related to marriage itself, right? Because pretty much anyone who is of age, and if you're in, you know, one of the same states that have same-sex marriage, pretty much anyone can get married as long as you are not related to the person, right? You can have the enough money, the $35 to get a marriage license, right? But why don't people do it? Because they feel that they don't have enough money. And you were saying this earlier in the conversation, but really it only costs $35 to get married. The people already might live together in a house by themselves. They might already have children. They might have already started a family. But for them, marriage is something that is so incredibly different than what they're doing, because they feel that they need to have a party, that they need to have a wedding, that they need to have this community recognition from other people that they are a married couple. Mm. And that's so important for so many people. But it places a different emphasis on what it means to be a family. An easy referent, a very easy referent that everyone can understand. Oh, this is what it means that those people are committed to each other. They have these values. They have a commitment to their children. It's an understandable signal in all these different cultures.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about how income inequality is reshaping American marriages. And we're talking with June Carbone. She's chair in law, science, and technology at the University of Minnesota Law School, and with Naomi Kahn, professor at George Washington University Law School. Their new book is Marriage Markets: How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. Also with us today from Seoul, South Korea, is Kevin Millard. He's professor at Syracuse University College of Law and co-editor of Loving versus Virginia in a Post-Racial World. Naomi and June, I just wanted to give you a chance to respond quickly to what Kevin was saying before the break there, and that is that maybe we should stop talking about marriage altogether, it feels as a somewhat of an antiquated notion, and really refocus or expand our view of what we think of as family or family structures. And June, I'll start with you.
Well, we talk about marriage because it is marriage that has become the symbol of class and continuing racial divisions in a world that insists, in the United States to a greater degree than other developed countries, on privatizing family responsibilities. So if you're going to say to families, you're on your own, we, you know, don't guarantee stable employment, we don't provide benefits for children, we don't even provide health care, even now on a universal basis, then families take up that burden, and the disparity in marriage exacerbate problems that aren't about marriage in the first place, but are certainly about economic inequality.
Mm. Kevin Millard, so one perspective I'm hoping you can bring here is, quite frankly, that of men, because a lot of this conversation, especially when we're talking about the challenges of getting married in for middle and lower income folks, and we've heard both Naomi and June say earlier that because the Great Recession and income inequality has hit men harder than women, that it's just harder for women to find, at those income brackets, men who have comparable incomes or you know, economic prospects. What do you make of that? And how could we, you know, further help men if indeed that is a major portion of this problem, should it exist?
Well, I think that we live in a modern world, but we stick to Mad Men values. Right, where women are caretakers and men are supposed to be providers. So according to most governments, a good parent isn't someone who spends time with their kids, who picks them up from school. It's someone who pays child support and someone who is not on public benefits. You can be a single parent, right, a non-custodial parent. You are considered a good parent by the government if you have a direct deposit that goes to your child, and you don't even have to have your child's name. So if you have a poor father who cannot pay child support, he supposedly is a bad parent, but it doesn't even account for the time that he might spend towards children, the time that he might spend with his own children. So maybe we should think of other ways of valuing families, valuing fatherhood, and valuing what these poorer men can add to their families, not just by being a paycheck and not just by being an ATM, but what is it that they can give qualitatively to their children and to their families? Mm.
Naomi Kahn, what do you make of that? I mean, it seems as if Kevin Millard is saying by this focus on the economic contributions of men that we may possibly be missing the point in terms of overall the many things that men can contribute to healthy and positive family lives.
I think there's an enormous amount of attention that's currently being given to what men can contribute. And just to sort of amplify a bit on some of the statistics, it's actually quite interesting in terms of the low-income men that Kevin was talking about. If you look at what happens when relationships dissolve, it's married fathers who are more likely to receive joint custody. And then if you go talk, as Kathy Eden and Tim Nelson have done in a wonderful book, if you talk to the low-income men about why they don't have joint custody or why they're not more involved in their children's lives, part of it is, as Kevin said, that they do see themselves as being only a paycheck. But part of it is that they themselves feel unable to assume the kinds of responsibilities that they would like. Part of it is that there's a high rate of incarceration, and part of it is just the lack of economic opportunities for them. And so what they're doing is spending a great deal of time not spending time with their children. So there is a problem. They certainly can contribute a great deal, but there are problems when it comes to their trying to be as involved in their children's lives as they would like. They are often themselves unable to do that.
Right. Well, we're getting a lot of input and feedback from our listeners. On the On Point website, Dee says that it's very difficult these days for smart, ambitious, college-educated women to find equal partners. Dee says she's married but currently making 5 times what her husband is, and they didn't start out with that big of a disparity, but he's not been as nimble and responsive to the changing marketplace as Dee has, and she says she's seen this over and over again. However, on the other hand, Bill 98 says, I disagree that for lower income women, their choices in male partners is limited. Rather, they are choosing to limit their options by insisting that they married up, which was the norm for generations. Let's turn to our callers. John is calling from Exmoor, Virginia. You're on the air, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to briefly say that this has affected me personally, and my partner of 8 years and I are no longer together. We've raised 2 kids. One's 8, One's a year and a half old. But I have been a working poor person my whole life. We're both well educated, and she stayed home with our kids. We could never really ever get ahead. And for us, always being like week to week on the checks and paying just kind of eroded our relationship and was sort of, it's just sort of a tragedy that this happened. We both loved each other so much, but we just couldn't spend any time with each other. We're working really hard. She was always exhausted with the kids. We never had time to go out together, and I see this happening more and more on our end.
John, I am so sorry to hear how much you have been struggling. Really, I mean, what do you think, looking back, might have helped hold your relationship together? I mean, short of getting a bigger paycheck.
Obviously, is one aspect, maybe living near to family. The career that I chose in school sent us to Florida, which was far from any of our family, and then we've had to move around to try and like step up financially. So we've never been able to have family nearby, which could have been helpful, and some support network. You know, we're kind of on our own, and that kind of isolation makes it hard when you're home alone and just stressed out and every evening.
John, thank you so much for sharing your story and for your call. June, Kevin, and Naomi, I think John really pinpoints something that is such an awful challenge for middle and low-income Americans right now. I mean, you heard him say that they actually moved around to try and pursue better economic opportunity, but that isolated them from their families, which might have been a source of financial and other forms of support, which made things even harder for them. So, you know, this makes me wonder, there's a huge list of possible solutions, but what might help families just like his, who are already doing what they can to stay together, let alone like, you know, get to the wedding altar. And June, let's start with you.
Well, optimism helped. One of the things that we certainly see in the literature is, again, one of the striking differences is you look at 1980 and couples who experience financial stress. Yes, they're more divorce prone than people who feel secure economically. Fast forward to the year 2000, the people who feel economic stress have become dramatically more divorce prone. And the people who are not experiencing financial distress have become dramatically less divorce prone. Why? I mean, you know, again, this is trying to hold other things constant. Why? And the answer is, and John captures that very nicely, is the tension between couples. The erosion of community support. When you look at families in the bottom half of the income ladder, they're less likely to move around, more likely to stay in the same place, but they're also more likely to see the communities around them deteriorating and that support declining. Mm. When you look at what happens when couples experience economic distress, one of the factors is coordinating expectations. The women who thought, gee, I'm going to be able to stay home with the child, now feels I need to work, and I need to work because my husband is not a success. Those women are resentful. The second thing is that we don't have a good role for men who help out unless they're also making money. So what Kevin was describing, the men in communities who aren't earning a paycheck often feel themselves they're not successful. And when you talk to the women, it's not that the man isn't earning enough money. It's his behavior. Mm. But that behavior often reflects how he feels about himself.
Kevin, do you want to respond or expand on that?
Yeah, I think one thing that we haven't been saying is, one, in June and Naomi's book, they have this wonderful way of saying how can we value families instead of being so American and talking about family values, right? They have all these wonderful recommendations that we could look at as, can we look at subsidizing childcare? Can we look at ways that people can feed children that would actually help families, like what the gentleman calling in was saying? Here's one statistic that is not said a lot is that when people get divorced or when they split up, and they have children, they owe child support to these children. But we can look at some of these statistics, and there's so much of child support that is just not paid to children, as much as $108 billion in 2009 had never been paid in child support to children. So when we think about where is it that support is coming from for these children, it's not from the government, it's not from other people, it's definitely not from the people who are supposed to be paying child support to these kids. And there's a problem there, because if people don't have money to pay, then it just exacerbates itself within these poor communities,
right,
who don't have any money to begin with, and then they don't have any money to give to each other or to their children.
I want to get one more call in here. Dan is calling from Greenville, Pennsylvania. You're on the air, Dan.
Hi. Something that I had been thinking about throughout the course of the show is that maybe what causes people to end up in a better socioeconomic standing is certainly chance, opportunities that they run into, but I think it's more of a just making good decisions throughout the course of one's lifetime, starting as early as, you know, high school, and taking classes seriously, making good decisions and choosing a career that's highly employable, sticking through college. And once you've done all of those things, I think you're a better decision-making person. And the choice that you make and, you know, finding a partner for marriage and having kids, you're going to just make those decisions far better. And that's what's going to cause you to stick in that marriage.
Dan, thank you so much for your call. Naomi Khan, what Dan says is not it's not an uncommon thought in terms of how people are making life decisions that lead them down the path that has an impact on income, families, marriage, everything we've been talking about.
Well, exactly right. As June said earlier, it's optimism that counts. So if you believe that if you get good grades in school, that you will ultimately go to a college where you will graduate and that you will then get a good job, if you believe in opportunities, then you are more likely to invest in yourself and in those opportunities. But there are numerous studies that show, for example, why is it that poor high school girls are more likely to have children at younger ages than are wealthier girls. And the reason, and I'm using the term girls because I'm talking about high school students, and the reason is opportunity. Opportunity is actually the best contraceptive available. And so if you believe that your hard work will pay off, then you are more likely to put in that hard work. But if you look around you, and if you look around, and as June and Kevin have been talking about, if you look around and you see that your community's disintegrating, that there are no good jobs available for you, then it's hard to think of just precisely what to invest in.
But if I may, all the optimism in the world, on the point you're making, all the optimism in the world sometimes still cannot overcome the endemic structural problems that a community faces.
Exactly. And so even if you're optimistic, you need to have, I mean, one of the things we emphasize in the book is it's not marriage. You don't have to promote marriage. What you need to do is to promote economic opportunity. And by promoting economic opportunity, it's amazing what problems can be solved.
Right. And June Carbone, last thought goes to you today in the last minute or so that we have. I mean, on that point, they're promoting economic opportunity. We've heard arguments for that before, childcare, maternity leave, other social supports. Do you think that they could have a profound impact on people's conception of marriage, regardless of where they fall in the income scale?
Sure. I mean, these are systems. And, you know, I keep talking about the feedback loops. I look at my children. They're looking around them. Their friends are getting married. They want to get married. And the ceremony itself is reestablishing ties to communities with in-laws, with their friends all over the country. It says a lot about them. But the other piece of that, when you think about these as systems, there's some great studies that show why is it poor kids aren't graduating from college as much? Well, they don't know how to get financial aid. They don't think about applying to Stanford, for example, even if they have the right scores, because filling out that application is complex, and they think they can't afford it. And sometimes they're turned off by the $100 application fee without realizing they're in an income bracket where it can be waived. Mm. What sophisticated parents do is they navigate those things for their children, figuring out waivers, financial support, getting the application done. Help. Right. Community matters.
Well, community, absolutely, community matters, regardless of it's if we're talking about children or families or the core building blocks of any community. Well, June Carbone and Naomi Kahn are co-authors of Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. June, thank you so much for joining us today.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
And Naomi, thank you to you as well.
Thank you. And wonderful conversation.
And Kevin Millard, co-editor of Loving v. Virginia in a Post-Racial World and professor of law at Syracuse. Thanks so much for joining us, Kevin.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.